Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, everybody. This is Janine, and you are listening to Lunch with Loudon. Coffee Talk radio shows are part of the Coffee Party Be the Media project. You can join our team at www.coffeepartyusa.com/volunteer. Hey, the Lunch with Loudon Brain Trust is looking for a research team, and so if that appeals to you, by all means, go to the website, let us know your interest, and we're good to go. So things are rumbling here in the foothills of the Oregon Coast Range today. I'm excited about our show. How about you up there in Portlandia, Debbie Lynn?
No, I'm so excited about our show. We, you know, every time we have Frankie or Frances Moore LePay on, it takes about a month or 6 weeks to work into her schedule. And so it's always like a big build-up for me because she's just awesome and so inspirational.
Well, and I think that she's totally a perfect guest for today. We've been having a few shows on the politics of food, and she is certainly one of the world's experts on this very subject. So to our listeners, I have a reminder that the number to call in and share or ask questions is 646-929-2495. Debbie Lynn will be monitoring the chat room, as always, and bringing comments here to us on the air. So you can participate that either way. We're also checking Join the Coffee Party Movement Facebook page, so comments there will be incorporated too. But to begin, it is clear today, not 2 days ago, certainly today, that there's mischief in our system of representation. Yesterday, the president asked the question, if 90% of the people want something and the Congress does not deliver, we have to ask, who are they here to represent? The show is not about gun control, but it is about money and politics, the very same issue that the president was pointing to yesterday. The victim of money in this scenario is food. Your food, my food, the food for the planet. As I mentioned in the blog about the show today, the well-funded agribusiness lobby and the strategic use of corporate and super PAC campaign contributions have made it impossible to have an honest debate about the citizen right to know what is in our food. There's little or no safety testing of genetically engineered food crops, and add to this the infiltration of individuals from agribusiness into regulatory agencies, that revolving door we all talk about. And we get, hey, why not? Decisions that amount to, don't worry your pretty little head about it, Nikki. I see that. For example, the Monsanto position on all things genetically engineered is that unless someone can prove that an apple is not an apple, then the level of safety of the non-genetically engineered food crop is the level of safety of the engineered food. You can't tell me that that's a scientific conversation. Corporate wordsmith called lobbyists wrote the rider to the agricultural appropriations section of the emergency appropriations bill and called it, you know, in their spin doctor ways, the farmer assurance provision. Food activists, in the turnabout is fair play, called it the Monsanto Protection Act. Controlling the narrative is everything in our branded society. We've talked about that here week after week. Despite the pre-planned wounded cry that a farmer should know when a crop is planted that he'll be able to harvest it, which is, you know, the justification for why this rider was good for everyone. Groups like Friends of Family Farmers called the bill a huge threat to farmers and citizens' rights, and it must be stopped. So there you have it. What is a concerned consumer to do? What is a concerned citizen to do? Citizens and corporate interests have the same gateway to change. For better or for worse, all change is in the hands of our elected. This is, you can call it the gateway, or you can call it the roadblock. In this and all matters legislative, Coffee Party believes that as long as political candidates depend upon contributions from corporate and special interests and need the same corporate and special interests to not support you know, the other guy if they don't play along. We have allowed a fog of corruption to nurture self-interest and starve out those who do not play along. The only answer is for us to free the elected from the influence of cash by adopting publicly funded political campaigns, returning the legislative focus from contributor interest to voter interest. So, where do we begin? Well, first, you have to actually believe that there's a connection between financial power and political power. This show has touched on this subject a couple of times in the last few months, and most often from a what is possible in a citizen-driven world, but sometimes from a stop it now perspective. Debbie Lynn and I have a lot to say about this, and I hope you do too. This week, we're thrilled to tell you that Frances Moore LePage is here. Debbie Lynn was talking about this earlier. She's making a return appearance in celebration of the paperback release of her most recent book, EcoMind, Changing the Way We Think to Create the World We Want. When she was here in September, she covered many of the things we can do individually. And today, we're going to ask her about the politics of food and the good food movement. She's the author of one of my life's Bibles, Diet for Small Planet, and many other serious works that can be found on her website, www.smallplanet.org. So, with no further ado, welcome to Lunch with Loudon, Ms. LePage.
Thank you so much.
So, we're so, as you heard, we're very excited to have you here. And but first, I want to congratulate you on EcoMind going into paperback release.
Thank you. I'm so excited about it.
Yes, we posted a groovy little picture. We have the blog talk flashcards that go by, the flash graphics that people are streaming the show. And so we got a picture of the book and put it on the flash, on the graphic drive so people could check it out. And
wonderful.
I guess, yes, and I guess the place to connect if you're interested in that book is to go to smallplanet.org. Is that correct?
And right. I just posted that in the chat room too. So if and anybody listening online, the chat room is after you look at our pretty pictures that they scroll by. If you scroll down a little bit, there's a chat room.
Great. I want to point out also that at smallplanet.org, if you go once you go to the EcoMind page, you'll see when you first get to our site, you just click on Learn More, and you'll see that we also have a workshop, or you can call it what you will, but kind of a group process people can go through, because I believe that this book is one that you really need to talk to other people about. It's not a book you just read and put aside, that's my dream, but that it really becomes a tool. And so we have a workshop that we put together. It has clips of my explaining some of the core ideas in the book, but mainly it gives people a chance to come together and reflect on how does this change them? How does this new way of thinking really sink into our bones? So I welcome people to try that out.
Well, I think that's great. And I, you know, the thing I really like to get into my bones is how can this new thinking empower us to take on this notion of well, I guess being the stand that we have a right to know what's in our food, that we have a right to choose according to our own philosophical lines about food, and the whole barrier gateway notion that it is our governance, it is our representatives, our elected that seem to be making this a difficult conversation. I know you have thoughts about this, and I just rather than guide this too much, I'd sure like to hear what you have to say about it.
Mm-hmm. Well, as I think we can agree that certainly with our food is so true, but in every dimension of our lives, the relationship to the environment, the frame that the dominant media are presenting to us is making us feel powerless and making us feel we have few choices and actually, of course, denying us information we need in the case of genetically modified organisms, denying us labeling, which is now, I understand, required in about 60 countries in the world, including some fairly authoritarian societies, and yet not in our so-called democracy. So, you know, I really think that first that we have to recognize how much of what we absorb in our culture may not actually be grounded in evidence. And to me, food is such a powerful way to make that breakthrough. And that's sort of what happened to me when I was in my 20s and realized, wait a minute, hunger is not caused by a scarcity of food. There's more than enough for us all, and that's even more true today. And yet there are still as many hungry people today as when I wrote Diet for a Small Planet. So while food production has gone up per capita. So food is a great place to start to begin to see what is real, what is evidence-based versus what we absorb through our media that is so dominated by corporate interests. So would you want me just to say a few words about genetically modified organisms as a case study in this?
I think that would be brilliant because I agree with you completely. It's like there's such a flood of bad information that sometimes the actual scientific work gets drowned out.
Right. And so I start where I begin when I think about genetically modified organisms. I think of it as a gigantic missed opportunity. That's my GMO acronym. What I mean by that is that if we stick with this frame that we are somehow dependent on going in this direction, we miss the opportunity, which is aligning with nature happening all over the world today. An understanding that is now being promoted through, you know, international agencies throughout the world and many governments on agroecology, aligning with nature to grow our food so that we can grow food safely and actually produce more. There are studies done at the University of Michigan that said that if we went entirely with organic agriculture, working with nature, that we could actually increase food production by as much as 50%. So going with genetically modified organisms, as I say, is a gigantic missed opportunity. And it's based in fear, and it's based in lack of science. It's not scientifically grounded in the sense that scientists tell us that it is a very crude technology. This is the great, I think, mythbuster, is that this is not sophisticated technology, that introducing new genes in this way that nature would never do, that it is unpredictable, that scientists have found that inserting a gene into another organism can result in multiple and unintended DNA changes. Unintended effects are common in all cases where this has been used. And so why would we take this risk? This is my number one question. Why would any savvy person take this risk if we didn't have to? Number one, we don't have to take any risks to feed ourselves. In fact, as I'm saying is that many people throughout the entire world are recognizing that we can produce more food without taking risk, that is by aligning with nature and growing food ecologically. So that's how I begin, that nobody can say that GMOs are not risky because I just read you the statement by scientists that unintended effects are common in all cases. And so we have over 100 scientists throughout the world who are saying, look, we need long-term experiments before we could ever have any sense of safety that this could be a beneficial thing, and that's not happening. And I would even go further to say there's no need to risk it.
Well, it is pretty amazing how many assumptions people make or the anecdotal things they're willing to incorporate into their belief system. I was at the Environmental Protection Agency, a research and development lab in the late 80s, early 90s. And, of course, we were trying to do peer review. We were trying to replicate science from industry and universities. And back then, of course, genetically engineered organisms were the hot new topic. And I can tell you for a fact that we were able to prove that we could keep them contained when we were in the laboratory. Right? We had all the protections that someone would have in a lab. But the minute we moved this work out to greenhouses, even though we had filtered air, even though we did booties in and out, even though we used lab coats and head covers and sometimes foot baths, you know, we could not contain those organisms, and we would find them outside our greenhouse environment. You know, because that was part of our science, was to capture it, you know, set up traps, so to speak, outside and make sure we were succeeding in containment. So even the notion that it's not going to get away, that it's not going to, you know, that we can actually control this living thing, it's pretty much known that it's not possible. And everybody talks about the Terminator genes, you know, like, oh, they can't replicate. Well, Terminator gene is one of those designer extras you have to order, you know? So it's not like it's in all GMO foods. So I share your frustration. And, you know, in our lifetime, the world population has doubled. And like you said, food production has more than doubled. And still we're still not finding a way to feed us all. And especially not to finding a way to feed us all well.
Yeah. Well, the line that I keep getting, that I keep hearing, is that we need GMOs so we can feed everybody and eliminate hunger. And I just don't see that as a viable solution.
No, I was just in India in the fall, and I met farmers, women farmers, who are taking leadership in their villages, and they have moved from destitution and hunger. They were dependent upon chemical agriculture, some of them using GM cotton, for example, which failed them, and there were suicides in the regions that I visited. This was once the pesticide capital of the world, Andhra Pradesh, where I was. And yet women farmers were moving to agroecological approaches in which they were making themselves completely independent of moneylenders, and they were not going into debt because they could share seeds, they could produce and share seeds. And the joy, the power, the brilliance, they were diversifying their crops, they were healthy. They said before they were so poor they could only afford one sari to wear. And so they had to wash part of it and let it dry while they, you know, I mean, it was just humiliating existence, as well as profound, you know, insecurity around food and in deep hunger. And now they are completely self-sufficient, and they've started their own marketing. They've started their own medicinal crops so they can have some of their own health care. They have their own radio station. They are teaching others. Now they have a caravan that's sharing of seeds going to 55 villages throughout their region. So this is the kind of approach that is not dependent on a laboratory somewhere and patented seeds that only the wealthiest can afford to begin with, and often, you know, don't produce what they say they are going to produce. This is an approach which we can all enjoy and benefit in very directly in our health, because in this region there used to be a lot of poisoning from pesticides, and now there are whole communities in which there are no pesticide poisonings because people have committed to organic agriculture.
Well, that's a major accomplishment. You know, last week we had folks on from the Ingenuity Innovation Center in Oregon, and they're basically doing demonstration farming with aquaponics. And I kept asking the question. It's marvelous. It was a wonderful show. And I kept asking the question, can you feed the world 20 acres at a time? And one of the answers I got back from Aaron was, you can feed the world 3 acres at a time. You know, and he pointed to other demonstration projects where even less land could be unbelievably productive. The space could be incredibly productive because, you know, we don't have to rely on, you know, till the earth, let topsoil blow away, and hope the sun isn't too hot and hope the rain doesn't come too soon or too late. I mean, we've evolved beyond that now. And so it's interesting that, you know, technology for some took this one turn, which was to modify organisms, and the other turn was to modify farming practices themselves.
Right. Right. No, I love, you know, when people say to me, well, you know, can this approach, the ecological agriculture, feed the world? Well, my first response, you know, is to say, well, we've shown that corporate-dominated chemical agriculture can't feed the world. So we know that's not working. And we have every evidence that aligning with nature, and when I say aligning with nature, I mean human nature too, that we do best when power is dispersed and when we feel that we're responsible and not dependent. And the model of agriculture that a corporation like Monsanto represents, this extreme form of monopoly of patented GMO seeds, we know that that brings out the worst in us. It makes us dependent and frightened. And, you know, the kind of intimidation that has gone on of farmers who just feel that, you know, if there's any GMO seed, patented seed that somehow got into their fields, that they could actually, you know, be sued and have to lose their land in a lawsuit. I mean, that's terrifying. So my point only is that we know the conditions that bring out the best, not just in nature, and that is not using deadly chemicals to grow our food, but we know what brings out the conditions, that we know what the conditions are that bring out the best in us. And that is the kind of thing I saw in India, where women were working together, meeting every week, and coming up with fields I walked in that you wouldn't think anything could grow in, and they had 20 crops growing. And I said, are you worried about climate change? And they said, no, we know what to do. We know so much about our land that if there's less rainfall, we know how to shift our crops and shift our practices, how we work the land to deal with it. And it was just, they were glowing with a sense of power. And these were among the lowest caste people in India, and I felt like they had more sense of power than friends of mine back in the United States.
Oh, that's very encouraging. It's so encouraging. Now, we have a few people that have been raising their hands since you got on the line. So do you mind taking a few callers?
Oh, I'd love to take calls, yeah.
Okay, so the first mic I'm going to open is from area code 541-620. You'll be next. Area code 541, welcome to Lunch with Loudon.
Is that me?
It
Hi.
Is you. Hi.
Oh, great. This is Barb. So first I want to say, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
I want to say, Frances, that I went to my first coffee party thing because I saw that you were going to be there.
Oh.
And that's where I saw Larry Lessig for the first time. And now I'm going to go to his Root Striker thing in San Francisco this weekend. I don't know if you know about that.
Fantastic.
But
yes. I'm leaving the day. I'm in San Francisco now, leaving the – yeah.
Oh, no.
I'm so sad to miss it. So sad to miss it. Will you email me and tell me what you got out of it?
Oh, yes, definitely. Well, and I'll tell you more than that. I have – so my 13-year-old daughter is – this is my question to you. She's – going to participate in a mock congress at school, 14-year-old daughter, I'm sorry, and she has chosen GMOs as her topic, and just this week she decided instead of saying, like everybody else says, that we need to label and we need to regulate, her sister suggested, how about instead of trying to fight the power of the GMOs or Monsanto, do something like Larry Lessig where he funds the opponents so that they can have a voice against the corporate-funded candidates for publicly funded elections. Maybe in this case, figure out how to empower the organic farmer instead of focusing so much on trying to limit the power of Monsanto.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I wonder what you think about that idea. And so one of her ideas is to subsidize organic farms, or you know, more actively. We have a lot of farm subsidies, so maybe we need to work organic farming into the farm subsidies that we're already doing. Or maybe similar to the government cheese program, where if the government's buying farm products, let's make them organic and supply, you know, feed the people who can't afford to eat. And it seems like these are maybe solutions that could sound, make sense to people and be working sort of from the other angle.
I love it. I love it. I love it. Yes, I mean, I totally am with this. And this is why I was you know, one of the things that keeps the GMO alive is that people believe there is no other pathway. And so that's why I was emphasizing the kinds of things that are emerging throughout the world, like I got to see in India. And equally true, you know, we don't realize, most of us, that the reason that chemical agriculture and the GMO approach is the one of the reasons it's quote-unquote successful to the extent that it is because it's subsidized and an ecological approach isn't. Less than 1% of our support for agriculture in this country, the taxpayer support, less than 1%, you know, goes toward ecological agriculture. So, yes, you know, basically that argument is powerful. And yes, legislation that would set the norm so that schools had to provision or hospitals could provision from organic farmers, that would change things radically. And this is what Brazil, for example, has done. Now, I think it started in 2010 that schools have to buy 30% of their school food from local farmers, and a lot of those are small farmers who are either using a lot less of chemical agriculture and GMOs or, you know, completely organic. In Rome, I understand that the school food is organic food. Just think what a change in the economy would be, in the farm economy, if schools required organic food, and think of the health of the children that would be improved by that. So I'm totally with that approach, and I love it.
Great. Well, I'll get to play this for her later. And so just quickly, I wonder, where should she look for good, you know, you're talking about information about GMOs and how, and like you said, there was a Minnesota, somebody quoting Minnesota scientists about we could do better with organics than we're doing with GMOs. Is there a good site, like your site, in somewhere in particular? Or?
Well, we actually just have a GMO fact sheet that we're just about to repost. We did some revisions on it. It's called 7 Things to Tell Your Friends About GMOs, and on the back of it are all the citations. Most of them are peer-reviewed, so that would be great for schools.
Right.
And if you email, this is what I'd recommend, email info@smallplanet.org. When is the presentation of your daughter?
Well, she's working on drafts now, and then she'll have a couple of weeks before, maybe a month before the actual hearing.
Okay.
You know, it's going to committee soon.
Okay,
but,
because this might be helpful because it's just so short. It's just one page and it has all the sources. So just ask us to alert you when the final version is back up. I think it's going to be today or tomorrow, but that could be just a little cheat sheet for her that takes her into the sources we have there are really good, credible, you know, peer-reviewed for the most part. Sources.
Great. Will you say that again?
info@smallplanet.org. info@smallplanet.org. Yep.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Good luck.
Thanks.
That's tremendous information. Our next caller is from area code 620. I think this is our friend Jack. Hey, Jack,
yeah.
You're on Lunch with Loudon.
Yeah.
Are you there?
Okay. The only, yes, I'm there. You hear me?
Yeah, I can.
Can you hear me? Okay. The only thing I have related that might be remotely related to the topic would be that a while back, Michelle Obama was saying that kids, they're advertising kids don't have enough to eat. If they don't have enough to eat, they can't learn. And I don't know where that can be. And then I think the idea is that another thing is that farm subsidies should be limited to small farms, not to Monsanto.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I like the idea of small farms.
whatever. Okay. Then I just, Frances Moore Laffey, I think she used to be a friend of mine on Facebook.
Oh, nice. Nice.
Yeah, we can be it again.
Okay, great. No, I'm with you. And of course, this is what, you know, the lesson from what you're saying, you know, that other countries, for example, Germany and other countries where they are moving more toward, much faster to organic agriculture, they help farmers make that transition, because the difficulty once you've been a chemical farmer is that it takes some time for your soil to renew and the chemicals to be removed from it naturally. And so that's what you need help at, to make that transition. But once you transit then and you become an organic farmer, often you can produce as much or more and have a better profit margin, because people are willing to pay a premium for that which keeps them healthy, many people who can. So I think that's key, absolutely key. I am totally with you. And your comment about Michelle Obama pointing out that poverty is a big part of the food problem, I couldn't agree more. And, of course, that's true throughout the world. I may have said that, I don't know if I've mentioned yet, but there's many people who are hungry today in the world as when I wrote Diet for a Small Planet 42 years ago, which is tragedy, an absolute avoidable tragedy, because we're producing 20-30% more food per person than we were then. And, of course, we are shrinking its capacity to feed us. So I think that really tackling the roots of poverty, which have to do with also these questions of our core assumptions,
also,
is key.
Okay. Also, I'm a diabetic.
Uh-huh.
And they should be being able to get figure out how to treat diabetic in certain foods, I think, are maybe no good for diabetics. We know that the famous three are French fries, potato chips, stuff like that, and soda pop. And soda pop and donuts.
Jack, you put me into a diabetic coma here.
I know. You know what, Jack? Yeah. You remind me of this horrifying statistic that more than 40% of the calories that our children are eating today are nutritionally empty. That is terrifying. And some of the things you mentioned are
sugar
right at the center of that diet.
It's just sugar, right? I mean, it's all that sugar we don't need that makes our pancreas work overtime.
Sugar and salt. Okay, I gave up on sugar and salt back in 1979, I think it was. That many years ago. And I guess that's kept me alive. I'm past 80. I'll be 82
good for you.
In June. And I think I've outlived longer than, my maternal grandfather lived to, I think, 89. That's as long as anybody I can think of in my family lived. And, I think that I think we're talking about you're talking about in your Facebook. I'm talking about Janine about you're a gal after my heart as far as blaming the Democrats as well as the Republicans as far as failure to advance certain legislation like gun control and gun safety. I would say, I don't want to say gun control, I don't like the word control, gun safety legislation, immigration reform. I think pre-K education will solve a lot of problems.
Indeed. Well, Jack, that's a whole money. that's a whole money and politics conversation, and today we're going to focus on food. But thank you so much for calling in. It's always a pleasure. Talk to you next time. So, I think that there's some food for thought here, certainly. And I know that way back, right when you were writing Diet for Small Planet, there was an energy crisis. The older among us will remember this. And oil was in demand. It was expensive. It was we were all going crazy about it. And, of course, the cost of food went through the ceiling. And then people who were doing agriculture, farmers and corporations, had a terrible time getting the petrochemical stuff they needed to maintain a particular way of doing business. And I remember it was like, I don't know if it's 1971, 1972, the Wall Street Journal did this great article, and they said, listen, all you wheat farmers who can't grow wheat because there's no oil, our recommendation to you from a financial perspective is go to organic wheat growing. You know, that there's great tax benefits.
I want to see that article.
Oh, you know, I remember it because I remember sitting in the commons at my university reading it and trying to tell people I knew. I live in Oregon. There was a lot of Eastern Oregon folks. They called themselves land poor. You know, when you own square miles, miles and miles of wheat land and you can't grow anything on it because you can't get your petrochemical fix, you know. And I was showing people this article, you know, saying the Wall Street Journal thinks you should do this. You know, there's money and rest in your land. You know, you get tax whatevers for resting your land, and the market is insatiable. They said people will pay a premium price. They'll pay whatever it costs to grow if it's organic. 1970, early 70s. And so I don't think the wisdom, well, I do think the wisdom was lost on a lot of people. And I don't know that the Wall Street Journal today would write such a thing, but it made a big believer of me. I mean, I'm a business person, and I thought that makes perfect sense.
Yeah, well, you know, again, it's the framing, right? The ecological approach has been presented as naive, marginal, incapable of mainstream, something that's actually a luxury that the world, I mean, that is the frame that the marginalizes this common sense approach that is working throughout the world and more endorsed by international agencies as really the solution. There was a major report done a few years ago that now, you know, 59 countries have signed on to that, you know, says that sustainable agriculture, the kind we're talking about now, is our future. This is not marginal at all. And yet here in this country, we're still sort of painted as being unrealistic. What is unrealistic is going on the way we are, as you say. I mean, obviously we can't continue a fossil fuel-based farming. So I want to come out as the real realists. We are the realists, right? That's the key.
I couldn't agree more. It looks like you've inspired more callers. Ready to take another one?
Oh, good. Wonderful.
All right. Here we go. I don't have a phone number. I have Vic. Vic, you're on the line. Hey. Welcome to Lunch with Loudon.
Hey there. How are you guys?
Hey, we're doing great.
Hi, Debbie Lynn. Hey, I've got a question. It's maybe a big one. It may be worth a book in itself, but I'm going to ask it anyway.
I love big questions.
Would you be open to discussing a little bit about your views on what I consider conflicting links between food, money, and poverty, and what you think maybe, you know, really the true barriers to real change? I'll get off and listen.
Okay.
Thanks, Vic. Great call. So what do you think?
Well, what do I think? I mean, I have a sense that being coffee partier, that we get it, that the link, you know, that we have, as I like to put it, privately held government. We have the best democracy money can buy. And so I really, really believe that whatever issue, and this Larry Lessig talks about this, you know, whatever issue that we care about, if we really look it in the face, we recognize that some of our good energy needs to go to stoking belief that we can get our democracy back through removing the power of corporations in both elections, but what happens after elections?
Well, certainly agriculture is one of those places where it's not only campaign funding that sort of twists the knife of corruption in, but it's also that there's this incestuous relationship between the regulated and the regulators, that revolving door. You know, so if
yes.
the guys at USDA used to work for Monsanto, guess what? You know,
right.
it's sort of a kind of a cronyism of its own.
So are you all aware of the American Anti-Corruption Act? Represent
yes.
us. And
yes.
what do you think of that as an approach? Because to me, that's the only approach out there that is really comprehensive, because a piece of that bill addresses exactly what you're talking about, the revolving door between legislators and corporate lobbyists. So I'm just curious what you all think of that approach.
Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, I mean, that idea has been around a long time, but we've never been able to, like, enforce it, so to speak, or have it come to fruition. And I think because we're waiting for the legislators, who are the ones who benefit from not having it in place, to enact it, to turn it into law. But, yes, we need it. But they're the ones who benefit, because they're the one who goes on to make millions as lobbyists when they get out of Congress.
Right.
So
how
else do we get it into law?
Well, this approach of Represent Us, I mean, is very clear about this, and the only way it's going to happen is, you know, the website represent.us asks us to become co-sponsors of the bill, and the spirit of it is that the only way this is going to happen is if right and left, conservative and liberal, pressure their Congress people and say, you know, we will not vote for you. You have to pledge that you will support this approach. And on the revolving door, it definitely strengthens that. Yes, we've had some laws, but not nearly strong enough. And so it would very much strengthen that, as well as provide ways for people to run for office, the kinds of things that Larry Lessing is talking about. He's on the board, or I don't know if it's the governing board, but anyway, he's on the Represent Us site as a part of this, because it is not just about corporate removing corporate funding and large door to funding and replacing it with citizen funded elections, but it also addresses other questions like transparency, disclosure, and also the revolving door and other aspects of the money in politics knot.
Oh, absolutely. When Congress gets called the farm team for K Street, you know you're in trouble.
Yes. And can I just tell you one statistic that underscores how dire the situation is? When you think of countries that are really moving as leaders in, say, renewable energy, and also in terms of things like employment and that sort of other issues, but Germany comes to mind. In 2010, even though Germany is very cloudy, it produced half of the world's solar energy, moving very fast as a leader in renewable energy and benefiting in terms of employment, just hundreds of thousands of jobs created. And on a scale of what countries are most infected with the infusion of corporate influence into political democracy, there's a ranking of 1 to 100, and Germany comes out the best at 83. And do you know where the U.S. sits? We are 29, tied with Tajikistan. So it's clear to me that there is a connection. There is a connection here that we have so much potential for renewable energy. In fact, you know, we've had a doubling just in over a 3 or 4 year period. We've had a doubling almost of capacity. And, you know, there's so much more potential, and yet it is blocked. I come from Massachusetts, and there it took 10 years. We're not quite there yet to produce one wind farm. There are now 55 wind farms, offshore wind farms, in Europe, and we, you know, we've just been working 10 years to get one. Why? Because one of the Koch brothers, put $30 million into blocking Cape Wind. And so we know the problem, the challenge is that we citizens have to believe we can address it.
It is remarkable. Go ahead.
Yeah, and there was a question in the chat room, Frankie. It was from Barb again, and that was just, you know, do you have, like, any information about how other countries have kind of broken through maybe the corporate messaging, or have corporations never had as much influence as they do here?
Not as much, but I think countries that we can look toward are, you know, I've been trying to read up on this, if anybody's interested, they could email me at info@smallplanet.org, and I could find some of, there's a global survey that had to do with different rules in different countries, and two of the winners, you know, two of the countries that I cite a lot as examples of real progress, one is Costa Rica, one is Germany, certainly, I've already mentioned, another is Costa Rica, which is, of course, you know, has one quarter of the per capita income we have. But they have rules about they do not allow corporations to be involved in their political process, and it's very clear. And they, for example, their election day is a holiday, and it's a celebration, and people pick up, you know, strangers to take them to the polling station, and it's a day of celebrating their power as citizens. And they've managed to move their country from a fifth of it being forested to half of their country being forested, and have all, you know, have reached about 95% renewable energy. So we know how to do this. We know what it takes to, but I believe that what's lacking among American citizens now is confidence that we can do this. And a movement, a real viable movement, that no matter where we stand on other issues, that this issue of money out of politics crosses all the political spectra, and we can come together on that. We need an identifying slogan and maybe an armband or a bracelet, a headband. We need a slogan, T-shirts, all of that stuff, that no matter where you're right, left, center, we can agree that democracy is citizens' voices, not corporate voices.
I think that's really brilliant. I think it's important to know that we have to be the stand for these kind of technological changes. We have to be the stand for a government that works. I mean, it sort of starts kind of in line with your book. It starts with believing that things are possible.
Yes.
Outside of what's handed to you. You know, and once you say that we can do this better, then other kinds of thought are possible. You know, and it's almost like, you know, when we've known how to use the sun, again, since you wrote Diet for a Small Planet, our ability to do it hasn't really grown that much. I mean, things have become less expensive, but the technology is there, and it's only been slightly modified in all that time. And yet, somewhere, we were convinced it's all or nothing. If you can't do everything with the sun, then you should do nothing with the sun. And now we sort of get, don't you think that was like one of those things that kept disbelief in order? And then once we were able to say, wait, we can be eclectic about our power supply. We can co-generate.
Right.
We can have these alternative conversations, and they're actually fiscally viable. You know,
right.
Then all of a sudden things
bust
out.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And of course, it's now proven. And I was just at a conference here in San Francisco, 100% Renewables Conference, the first international one, and with the mayor of San Francisco, with scientists from all over the world. I was speaking there, and I was listening as well. The listening was the best part. And I was hearing scientists from all the world saying, absolutely, there is no technical obstacle to 100% renewables within a few decades, that it's massive. Amount, you know, the sun supplies us 15,000 times the daily dose of energy that we currently get in fossil fuel. And so what I argue in EcoMind, and this is the new science I love, is that as we have these new thoughts and new frames of possibility instead of lack and scarcity, that we actually physically change our brains. We create new pathways in our brains, and we start seeing possibility where we didn't see it before. So this is the power of an eco-mind. We can change ourselves by what we put into our minds, and that means seeking out sources like you all. like so many in my book EcoMind, I have so many lists of, you know, the kinds of websites I use for getting stories of possibility coming into my life every single day, and I start seeing the world differently. I start, you know, listening to different voices, and it changes me. And we can do this.
Oh, absolutely. And I just want to point, might save you some effort, that if you come across references that you decide after the show you'd like to share with us, you can post them at Lunch with Loudon Facebook page, and then we can share them with our whole listenership. So it's not for one or the other of us, you know, to have to manage that. And I'll repost it if you post it there, and we'll appreciate it a lot, because this will generate a lot of conversation, I think, between the folks who are really trying to take that step to really wrapping their arms around the fact that not only is government or big money or you name the boogeyman a barrier, but also our willingness to believe that there's something else possible is actually stopping us whether we know it or not. And mm-hmm. and I think it's a huge piece of the conversation right now. So, Annie, let's see, we're coming up to the end of our hour, and I'm interested in any last words you might have. I see that our Egberto Relays is standing by. I'm going to open his mic and let him say hello. And hello, Egberto.
Hi, how you guys doing? First of all, wonderful show, one that I think is absolutely needed.
I'm glad to hear that you enjoyed it. Do you have any questions for Francis Moore-Lopez or any comments on the show so far?
Yeah, well, I enjoyed it. I understood what she's talking about, and I love everything that she said. I think one of the things that I love for her to explore is something that she said earlier about Americans have to feel within themselves that they can do it. You know, I've always spoken about us as a country sort of having a self-esteem problem. You know, yesterday, the way the vote went in the Senate, in as much as most of Americans definitely wanted something, they look up in the afternoon and see that their senators voted diametrically opposed to what they want. How would you rebuild that that self-esteem, if you will, when every time a vote comes along, you see these guys voting diametrically opposed one's own interest?
Mm. Well, I love it that you couch it in terms of self-esteem, because I totally agree that that the sense of powerlessness does make us feel have very low self-esteem. And that's why suicide is increasing. That's why depression is increasing. It's symptoms of low self-esteem, understood as powerlessness. And so I think I'll repeat what I said earlier, that what's missing and what I want to be part of, I feel the coffee party is part of, that you calling in can be part of, but we have to make it visible. There is a movement that is not partisan. It is about democracy, not about a particular viewpoint. It is about allowing citizens' views to hold sway. That is allowing true dialogue, not dialogue with a secret agenda because you're funded by a big corporate power. So we have to believe that real democracy is possible. And to do that, yes, we have to have examples from other places, and we have to have a movement. And anything that you, the caller, that folks who are meeting in San Francisco with Larry Lessig and Root Strikers, how do you take this out of a narrow legislative kind of wonky thing and into a national movement that we can all identify with? I mean, I'm a child of the 60s. I grew up feeling that I was part of a movement. It was so exciting. We had songs. We had slogans. We had, you know, a look, if you will. And we need something even broader today that's not partisan, that is about democracy. And I call it living democracy movement, that democracy is a way of life that is all about cultivating citizen voices as decision makers. So I want to be part of that, and I want to know what's going on. I can't make it to the conference, but I want the spirit of that Root Strikers conference this week. I believe it's the 20th. Is that right?
Yes.
To infect us all, and so I really encourage people to check out represent.us, represent.us is an interesting entry point, and Larry Lessig is part of that as well, as a way to really say, to stand up as citizens.
Thank you.
Brilliant. Brilliant. Well, thank you so much, Egberto.
Thank you very much. Great job.
So, again, we're coming to the end of our hour, and I'd like to remind folks that Coffee Talk Radio is on the air 4 times a week, Mondays at 7 p.m. Pacific, 10 p.m. Eastern. Dan Aronson hosts Press 1 for Democracy. Tuesdays at 5 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Eastern, conservative Michael Charney and progressive Eric Beiler host The Middle Ground. Thursdays, of course, you're right here, Lunch with Loudon, noon Pacific, 3 p.m. Eastern. And then Saturdays, 10 a.m. Pacific, 3 p.m. Eastern, Egberto Willés, we just heard him, is hosting Politics Done Right. Frances Moore Lopez, this has been such a joy. It's always fun to talk to you, and it's even more fun to follow up and go look at the things you pointed us to. I'm going to ask Barb, if she's still listening, to blog for us when she comes back from San Francisco. Maybe I'll even find a way to write down there with her. I think that would be great. And, again, feel free, please, to post anything you like on Lunch with Loudon. It comes over there on a side post, but we'll just repost it post-haste. So thank you.
Okay.
Thank you so much for joining us again.
Oh, it was great. It's exactly the kinds of things that I want to talk about. So your callers and you are totally aligned with what I think is so important, and what I'm saying in EcoMind, you know, that shifting, I take 7 thought traps and I flip them to what I think are empowering thought leaps, and that's all about my life right now. So thank you, thank you. I'm so proud to be part of the Coffee Party community.
Well, we couldn't be happier. Thanks a lot.
You're so
welcome. I want to remind everybody that Coffee Party USA is a grassroots organization funded totally by our members. Citizens United has not benefited us. If you like the show or anything else you see the Coffee Party doing these days, become a Coffee Party member by going to www.coffeepartyusa.com, or if you get that email reminder that it's time to renew, renew generously. You can do a one-time-a-year membership, or you can join me and be a sustaining member and have a little bit coming into the Coffee Party every month. We appreciate all of you very, very much. So, with no further ado, I'd like to say goodbye. Thank you, Debbie Lynn. It's been a tremendous show.
Yes, it has. I always love having Frankie on.
And
you ready to really hit the button?
I am. Coffee Party on.
There we go.